history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some great stories in your neighborhood if you take the time to listen to them. Men and women from our greatest generation, we hear from them every week on this program. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired. Today, perhaps if you spent a little time in Oakhurst, California with Sarge Sargentini, you might be amazed at what great shape he's in at 91 and all the things he's got around this property. You can look at some pictures at the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or hometownheroesradio.com. But let's go way back. A young boy, your family moves from Arizona to California, and you had two brothers, two sisters. Growing up in gold country, was the gold rush still somewhat recent history as you're growing up in the 20s and 30s?
Yes, it was. We lived in Bear Valley, and there were miners all over the place right there. In fact, I worked in a mine.
What'd you do in the mine?
I was a trammer. That's pushing a gold cart in and out of the mines to empty the ore that the miner had dug up.
I think most people probably wouldn't know the answer to this. They think gold rush, they think, 1849 and maybe 20 years after that. They don't know that in the 1920s and 30s, there might still have been a little gold. How much gold was still left at that point?
Well, there was enough of them that there were at least a dozen well-known mines. They were famous around the area in the Golden Key. The Pine Tree Mine were some of the big ones, and the Dilt, where I think they took out a 50-pound gold nugget one time. So there was lots of mines, and I was fortunate enough to work at the Pine Tree as a trammer.
And I'm just guessing here. I'm imagining myself in your shoes. If I'm growing up at that time and I'm working in a gold mine and I've got two brothers and two sisters, I bet there was a lot of daydreaming among those five kids of, hey, maybe we're going to find the giant gold nugget here or there. Did you ever go looking?
Yes. I used to have a sluice box in the creek in Mariposa Creek right down below the house. We built the house, and the creek was right down below us, so I used to do a lot of panning. I didn't get rich, but I picked up some gold. And we lived in an old stagecoach road, and while we were digging the house foundation, I remember my brother picked up a silver dollar, that, oh gosh, I must have been 1,000 years old, but he got rid of it in town for candy. So we never did find out how old it was or anything. Somebody took advantage of him.
The persuasive pull of sweets. Sometimes it never changes. And besides finding the mother lode, do you remember what kind of ambitions you had as a young man, what you dreamed about doing someday?
Well, there was logging, and I really didn't have any idea of what I was going to do from high school. I went into the 3Cs, and from the 3Cs, I drove truck in Alaska.
And I want to hear about that, and I understand you were there on a pretty significant date in world history there in Alaska. But for folks today, a teenager in school right now, you say the 3Cs, and I don't think they know what you're talking about. So you're a sophomore in high school, and you leave high school to join the Civilian Conservation Corps. Why did you do that? What made that decision for you?
Well, our family was poor. I had a chance to make some money, it seems like. So at $30 a month in room and board, I went into the Civilian Conservation Corps, and out of that, $25 was taken out of my pay and sent home. Mm-hmm. And I was left with the rest, which was ample because $5 bought a lot back in those days.
Especially in Alaska, I'm sure. But something tells me, as much as you do get a little dusting of snow in Mariposa County, it probably paled in comparison to what you faced in Alaska. Were you prepared for what you encountered up there?
We were in the Aleutian Islands, and it wasn't as bad as it is in the inner part of Alaska right there. We got mostly a lot of storms and rain, a lot of rain. And we did get a dusting of snow, but not drifts like, 3-4 feet deep. We were in a bay they called Tongass Bay for a year, and we built a landing strip for airplanes. I was there from the beginning till, no, not from the beginning, but close to it until the end, where we witnessed our first plane to land there, and it was Army.
Well, because by that time, something had happened. And, you know, every veteran I've ever had on this show, hundreds of them, I ask them all the same question. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Where were you, and how'd you find out? I don't think I've had anyone tell me they were in the Aleutian Islands that day. What do you remember about December 7th?
Well, I remember December 7th, we had come in from work. I was a jackhammer person at the time before I started driving truck. I remember coming in, and that night we were alerted. The island got put under martial law, and they said that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. The air raid alarm sounded that night, and we could see, we all went out into the trenches, which had been prepared by the engineers, and while we were sitting there talking and joking and what have you, because we didn't see anything, all of a sudden we saw lights up in the heavens, and we thought they were searchlights from Japanese boats, and that's what we were told. So as we watched them, they never came to anything. It was the Aurora Borealis that was shining up there, but we all had a good laugh about that, but it was serious for a while.
The Northern Lights almost got you.
We did get training while we were there. We were forced to live just like the soldiers did. In fact, there was a division right behind us on the same island, and they're the ones that we worked under, an engineer division, and we had Army personnel that commanded us.
So you were almost in the Army before you were in the Army, and maybe that's fitting, because I'm sure they called you Sarge long before you had any rank at all. Did you ever have some fun with that, or confuse some people with them just calling you your name and your nickname?
Well, not while I was in the 3Cs, but when I was in the Army, yes. We were in formation one time when we first got there. We didn't even know how to stand at attention, hardly, but it was on a Saturday, and we were lined up, and the lieutenant hollered, "Hey, Sarge, Sarge, Sarge," and he kept, nobody moved, and he came up before me, and he says, "I mean you," and I said, "Yes, sir, yes, sir," and he says, "Take these men and take them to the barber shop and get them a hair of this," so forth, you know. So I did. The next day he apologized. He says, "I heard them calling you Sarge." He says, "So I thought you were a sergeant." So that's how I got my first promotion.
Do you remember how old you were when people first started calling you that, or when they stopped calling you Julian and went with Sarge?
Oh, it's been forever. My brother was little Sarge. I was Sarge, and my dad was big Sarge. We all went by those names there in Mariposa. Everybody knew Little Sarge and Sarge and Big Sarge.
I can imagine having a lot of fun with that in the Army. How did you end up in the Army? How did that all unfold?
So I was drafted, and I served my time. I wound up in the infantry, in the 75th Infantry.
Yeah, and you ended up in some pretty sticky situations and some pretty cold situations in Europe. And when you headed overseas with the 75th Infantry Division, I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember your state of mind? Did you believe you'd be coming back to America someday, or did you wonder if you'd end up over there and not coming home?
I never gave that a thought about not coming back. I always thought I would, and we went over in one of the largest boats that they had at the time. It was a ship, the Aquitania, and that was a sister ship to the Lusitania, and it was huge. Anyway, on the way, we thought we saw periscopes and all that, but we had planes that fly over every once in a while, you know, so we never worried too much. We were just soldiers. We let the higher-ups worry.
And in an infantry division, there are a lot of different platoons, a lot of different squads, a lot of different duties. What was your job in the 75th Infantry Division?
I was with the wire team. We were special troops, and they taught us how to run lines, how to splice them, how to communicate by radio, by signs, by any way we could, from one switchboard to another. So we went from, from division to regiment, and from regiment down to company, and from company down to the units. So we always had to keep in communication. Now, I wasn't a fighting man. We followed the fighting guys. Right to wherever they went, we went. We had radios back in those days, but they were big and bulky, and sometimes you couldn't get out with them, so we always needed telephones.
And when you're using telephone, that means there has to be a physical telephone line extended from one end of that to the other, and you're one of the guys that was rolling that line?
Exactly, yes. We were taught how to climb poles and how to fix temporary overhead lines and undergrounds and all those things like that. And then we were taught how to keep them in maintenance because there was always shelling and tanks, everything that could go wrong. One tank could go roll over a line and he'd take out a mile of line. You know, or everything that you had put in there, he'd just wrap it up in the treads. And so we had to be always on the lookout and be ready to run new ones.
And you said something there. You said, I wasn't a fighting man. I don't know that the Germans knew that. It's not like you had a big red vest on that said, don't shoot me. I think you were probably in as much danger as anybody else. When was your first taste of it? When was the first moment where you realized, hey, I could get killed out here?
That was in the Soy Houghton area. It was Christmas. We went into fighting just around Christmas right there. We were in the lines during Christmas. I remember it was just out of Soy that I was in my first blow-up. Somebody stepped on a mine, or what happened, we don't know. But anyway, there was about 8 engineers that were killed that night, you know. So, and before that, our unit had been in combat, and we lost quite a few men. I'll never know just how many, but we knew that we had lost a lot of them. And we stood out in the snow with our dark uniforms. We didn't have camouflage like the Germans did. They had white uniforms, and we didn't. We stood out like stumps out there in the field, in a white field, so we were good targets.
And this is what would become known as the Battle of the Bulge. This is about a week into that, and the 75th was called in as part of that. So you mentioned that incident, and I, you know, not to get gory or harp on it, but just so people understand what you went through. So this is at nighttime, and pretty close to you, a mine goes off. It kills 8 guys.
I was blown up in the same thing, and I suffered a broken pelvis bone at the time, and that was about the extent of my injury on that one right there.
So you must have been pretty close to this mine that went off.
We were. I don't know just how close it was, but I remember the guys laying around, and one of the lieutenants right there, he crawled over and he says, are you hurt, soldier? I said, no. He says, I don't think I am, you know, because I was deaf, but I could make him out. And I said, no, I'm not, because I could move. And he says, okay, help me. So we dragged a few carcasses out of the way and took some over to by that time the medics had set up a temporary aid station, and we took some boys over there. So anyway, that was my first taste of real getting into the action.
Well, you say that's your first taste. I mean, that's a smack in the face. And you're describing it. I just want to be clear. So this mine explosion, it knocked you from your feet into the snow?
Yes. It knocked me up against a wall. And I don't know just how I hit the wall, but with my back. And I think it was a sharp box or something, because there was a lot of crates laying around between the wall and the crates. I hit something, and it hit my back end. Anyway, that was my first taste of it, the real action. Before that, it was just running lines. We thought of, you know, we kept looking for relief. They told us we'd be relieved in 3 days. We kept looking for that third day. Well, the third day came, and there was no relief. And then the fourth day, and the fifth day, and the sixth day. And it went on like that. Pretty soon, we just gave up, you know.
Again, I'm just, you know, imagining what this must have been like for you. And this is Christmas time, 1944. So you're only 20 years old. You're out here half a world away from all your family. It's freezing cold. You get blown off your feet into a wall. You can't hear because of the concussion of this mine. And then you just said something that you guys, in trying to help with the situation, you were dragging carcasses through the snow. Now, those carcasses a minute before were your buddies, guys that you'd been serving with out there. How did you handle the emotions in that moment, or were you just completely numb to it?
They were engineers, and I knew some of them, but you never get real close to another unit. You know, you see them and work with them and like that, but you don't know them very well. And while we were there anyway, after that little deal was over, we were still in the area. It was New Year's Eve, and we opened up with everything that artillery had in the background, and the Army had in the background, they threw everything they could for a New Year's present to the Germans. And they did. They pounded the heck out of them for a long time. But then the Germans threw some of it back at us, you know, but not as much. But I remember that barrage right there that came.
And I need to stop you there because it's time for a break. But when we come back, we're going to find out what happened next. And Wyatt has left Sarge Sargentini with a strong aversion to a song you might enjoy each holiday season. To see what Sarge looked like then and what great shape he's still in at 91, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most from their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. It's simple, rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, a proud supporter of Hometown Heroes.